Hey, welcome back. I told you there was going to be more shows. So for those of you that listened to my little six-minute teaser, this is Corey back after a busy summer. Talked a little bit about his baseball adventures, coaching the high school all-star game at Comerica Park, and helped coach his kids' team through the state tournament and getting into that, and then a little bit of differences between coaching kids and coaching the high school kids as well, and just the different strategies on that. And then we dive deep into fantasy football, which kind of got us off into a little bit of baseball conversation, talking about a little fantasy baseball and injuries, of course, with Bryce Harper going down, and some stuff on Colin Kaepernick and Tim Tebow too that I think you guys will enjoy. And right in between both of the sections, some hard-hitting food questions, so make sure you guys check that out. As always, thanks for listening, and enjoy. All right, Corey Farner is back with us, and Corey, you've had a pretty busy summer. It's been a little bit since we talked. What's been going on?
Nothing, man. I mean, it's just been baseball. That's the only thing that's been going on. You know, mine ended up in June, and then we had the Michigan High School All-Star Game. And then my kid, you know, both of my kids have been playing baseball. My youngest was in T-ball, so that kind of got over early. But my oldest, Lucas, got involved with the Little League and stuff, and then he made the All-Star team. So they go on to these, you know, tournaments. They ended up doing quite well in the first one, which was like a district with 16 teams, and they ended up winning that.
Nice.
And then went on to the state tournament, which I think was 12 teams. And that was in Taylor as well. So that was kind of cool. We didn't have to travel real far for that, obviously. Yeah. So, and he played in that and, you know, they did all right. They, you know, were respectable in terms of, you know, how they matched up with some of these other teams, but, you know, Lucas being 8 and playing 10U, most of these other teams were mostly 10-year-olds, you know, and they were good. I mean, I probably saw the best 10U baseball player I've ever seen. In one of these games. And I mean, the kid was, I mean, it was unbelievable how good he was at 10 years old.
So talk about that, you know, a kid, an 8-year old playing with 10 year olds. How do you feel? You're his dad, but then obviously you're a coach too. So you have an eye for talent. Mm-hmm. Do you recommend it if they can play that level, or do you want them to kind of just stay at the same pace?
You know what? It's a good question. I think it depends on your location and what's going on in your neck of the, you know, your neck of the woods. In our situation here in Michigan, there's a ton of travel teams out there, and you know, the talent pool has kind of been flooded. So, you know, Little League was an option. Well, Little League works out great, you know, if you have good talent at that age group. Well, in Lucas's case, he started early, around 6. And was playing hardball, did a great job, catch, throw, kind of understood the game, you know, and it became like that level was too easy, you know, like he'd pitch and nobody would really touch him. He'd hit, you know, him and his buddy, they're along the same lines and talent. And it just was obvious that like, if they continue to play at that level where they're supposed to be, chances are someone's going to get hurt off of a ball, you know, coming off of their bat type mm-hmm. of thing. Or if, you know, they're pitching and they, you know, let one go hard and it goes in and hits a kid, you know, in the back or in the head or whatever, those kids won't have the reaction time to get out of the way.
So you don't think about that, like a safety standpoint too. These kids are so talented and they're so advanced that it becomes a safety hazard for some of the other
kids.
That's
exactly, for our Little League, that's exactly what it was. So, we, like right now, this year, he was 8, and he could have played in what was the farm division, which is a 7- and 8-year-old division. But we moved him up to the minor division, which is the 9-10-year-old division, just because of the safety issue. Now, you know, with the way our situation's working and the reason why we did go to travel at this point, we're going to kind of play a hybrid schedule with Little League, is because next year, the group of kids that he played with this year are all moving up to the 12-year. And Lucas is, you know, going to be 9. And I'm not going to move him up, you know, to a 12U division because that's where, you know, the talent level's at. He's still 9, you know, and the reaction speed at that point, it becomes a safety issue with him.
For him.
You know, you get a 12-year-old. There was a 12-year-old on the All-Star team this year on the 12U that was 6'2" and, like, probably 250. Wow. You know, I mean, yeah, he was bigger than I was.
What country was that kid from?
What's that?
What country was that kid from?
He's from Taylor. I know, man. He's like, he's huge, dude. And his parents were like normal size. It was weird. But you know, the kid was good. But that's, you know, I can picture now next year, my 9-year old playing in that league and that kid hitting a line drive at him. I don't care how good, you know, my kid is or any kid. If you don't have that reaction speed to catch up, then it doesn't matter how talented you are and you can get hurt.
Right,
so
exactly.
What we did was this year we decided that, you know, kind of gauging what's coming up in that division and what's leaving and what's kind of going to be there is that maybe we should go to a travel ball team and hook up with guys that are his own age, you know. So this team that he'll be on next year will be all 9-year-olds. Now, grade-wise, they'll be a little bit different depending on when their birthdays are, but they'll be 9. And that way he can play with kids. And on this particular team, they're all just as talented, if not more talented than him. You know, so now he's surrounded by good players, and the competition level's higher, and it's more like baseball. You know, even in the Little League, being 8 playing with 10U, you know, he would hit a ball on the ground, and it was a 50-50 shot if it was going to be fielded cleanly and thrown to first base.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a pretty fast kid, so, like, a lot of times he's getting on base. And, you know, as a father, I'm happy for him, you know, because I know he's enjoying it. But as a coach, I'm thinking, well, you know, if he was playing against, you know, talented 8-year-olds or 9-year-olds in that situation, you know, that are playing every weekend and playing 50 games a year type of thing and practicing and doing the right things, he's out, you know. So now you got to try to coach your kid up a little bit. Be like, listen, I know the results were really good. You know, you got on base 3 times. But in the real world of what baseball is going to be when you get older, you're probably 0-for-3 or 1-for-4 in that situation.
Right.
You know, and so you kind of have to, you know, you don't want to kill the kid's confidence, but at the same time, you don't want to give him or allow him to have that false sense of success. You know, have fun with it and pick your chances of being able to explain that. But, you know, make sure that, you know, they understand, like, they got to do things the right way.
Did you coach the Little League team too?
I helped out, you know, with coaching high school. I couldn't be the head coach of the Little League team, so I helped out. And I actually had to help out quite a bit during the All-Stars. We had a couple coaches that were the coaches, but were also coaching in different divisions with their other kids. So there was a lot of, like, you know, the Little League that we were at, the major division and the minor division all went pretty far. The major division, which is the teams that go to Williamsport that you see on TV,
yeah,
they went to the state tournament as well, and they went up to the UP, and they ended up losing to the Grosse Pointe team won the state championship and now is going to Williamsport because they just won the region.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I saw that they made it through. That was the first time that they had gone. Is that the first time a Michigan team's been to Williamsport?
I want to say no. I want to say it's happened before, and I want to say it's possible that it was Grosse Pointe again, to be honest with you.
Okay.
But I'm not sure on that.
Yeah.
I think there's been a Michigan team to be there, and there's going to be another one that's going to be in the Junior League World Series in Taylor. This little league is, like, from Saginaw area.
Okay.
Saginaw area. So there's good representation this year. So, you know, it's just one of those things that you have to navigate. Now, if I lived, you know, out west or, you know, down south where I think maybe there's a lot more baseball going on and there's a lot more kids playing baseball, maybe the talent level is a little bit higher, maybe I wouldn't think going to travel is the best situation. You know, like, personally as a dad, I didn't think that we needed to go to travel until he was, you know, at least 12 years old, you know, 12 or 13.
So what's the difference when you're coaching, when you're going from high school kids to helping out and coaching these little league kids? Do you got to tone it back, or do you kind of take the same approach, just a little softer?
Yeah, you know, you do have to tone it back. Like, that's that softer approach. But you teach the same fundamentals. I mean, it's, you know, the fundamentals you teach an 8- and 9-year-old is the same type of stuff that you're teaching an 18-year-old because they need to be reinforced. A lot of times kids, and even, you know, this happens at any age, but you become an athlete, you're a good athlete, or you're taller, bigger, stronger than everybody else of your age group, and you can get away with making mistakes and still being successful. You know, I played ball with a kid at 12 years old who was, you know, just stronger than everybody else. And every time he hit a fly ball, it was a home run. you know, but his swing had huge holes in it. And we knew that, you know, kind of once he got older and kids are going to start throwing curveballs and changeups, that he wasn't going to be as successful. And it is exactly what happened. You know, because you start getting in the habit of doing things the wrong way because you found success doing it. So when you're coaching little kids, you know, it's just, you got to make it fun. Their attention span is like 12 seconds. And so you have to make sure that you get your point across and that you're describing it and showing them how to do it. So you have to model the behavior you're looking for, whether it's fielding a ground ball or running onto the field. You got to show them so visually they can see it before you can expect them to do it. Now, high school, it's a little bit different. I mean, you still have to model a lot of the skills, especially some of the advanced stuff that they have to learn how to do. But a lot of the fundamental stuff should have already been kind of taught and learned. And we make sure that we do a good job of that at some of our lower levels when they come up. So the message is just, you know, a little softer for the younger kids. But, you know, we try to get them doing some of the same fundamental drills and some of those little games that we do to make it fun.
Yeah, I got to tell you, Giovanna finished up her spring season and she's in the middle of her summer season right now. And these were her first seasons of baseball. And bless those coaches, man, because I can tell you, it gets – to me, I understand this is her first time playing, and some of these kids, you know, they're not the most coordinated yet. You know, she's seven. It's coach pitch still, and they haven't split them off into softball or fast pitch or the, you know, kids are pitching yet. But, right. You know, I can sit and work with her, and her swings look great, and I'm watching her hips, and I'm watching her shoulders, and I'm watching everything. But when she gets in, you know, when she gets in that batter's box and the pitch is coming, it's just that bat swings her out of the way. You know, like you'd feel that bat was 100 pounds the way that she was swinging. And, you know, you tell her, like, hey, man, when you're at home and you're swinging great. And the coaches even tell her, too, like, you know, you're swinging great when you're doing your practice swings. So after you see that after a couple games, it's just like, I have to control myself. I bite my hand. I bite my lip. And it's just like, she's seven. I got to remember she's seven. So I can't imagine you with a whole team of these kids where you see, like, put your glove on the ground and the ball's not going to get through it, you know, and you do it at home. Why can't you do it during the game?
It is a little bit like a broken record coaching young kids, you know, especially in the intro level of baseball, because, you know, it's not like football or basketball or soccer where you're constantly moving, you know, like T-ball. I mean, you're asking these kids to sit there and watch this kid try to hit the ball off a tee or off a coach pitch or something like that. And just by chance, if it goes near you, then you field it and throw it. You know, it's tough to kind of get them going. So the best thing that I could tell you is, you know, as a father is, hey, try to make it fun, you know, really be positive and talk it up, because if they don't have the passion for it, then it'll never turn into anything.
They won't want to improve.
They won't want to do it, you know. So what you're doing at, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old is you're just trying to kind of facilitate their passion, right? They have an interest in it, and you're just trying to kind of, you know, get them more involved and experience things. And maybe that interest becomes a passion and they just really love it and they want to do it and they want to get better, you know. But a lot of times you'll see kids, you know, by 10, 11, 12 years old, they're out of baseball altogether.
Yeah, she had fun. I mean, she had fun, and there was actually in the middle of the spring season, she got on a nice little hit streak and, you know, started putting contact with the ball, and you could see she was really having fun with it. But, you know, I'm glad she stuck it out and everything. But like I said, I look at these coaches, and, you know, they're parents, they're coaches, and they're almost teachers at the same time. You know, like you said, they're trying to keep it positive. And, you know, me being so into sports and everything, and this is my first kid, like I remember watching her swing, and I'm getting so technical with her, like, you know, if you dip your shoulder, and she's like, I gotta remember she's seven, and she's, you know, she's not gonna know all this technical stuff too. So we try to watch ball games and everything. I'm like, you pause it and then you slow motion it and everything, and you know, I pick it up, but like, she's seven, I gotta remember. And
well, even Lucas, who, you know, plays at a high level right now, he, you know, he doesn't understand a lot of the things that I'm, you know, trying to tell him sometimes. And I usually got to take a step back and be like, all right, I got to attack this a little bit different, because even though I want him to do, you know, this thing, you know, hitting, how do I get him there?
Right.
You know what I mean? Without like sounding like I'm trying to teach an 18-year-old about hitting, you know what I mean? So I got to, you know, dial it back. But sometimes it's you're teaching a skill that leads into the skill that you actually want them to do. you know, and that's, it's just scaffolding. That's what it's called. Yeah. I mean, you just have to scaffold the information to them and bits and pieces and be patient. And, you know, I got to be honest with you, with Lucas, sometimes I got to struggle with that patience part of it because, you know, he's pretty talented and he loves the game. And sometimes, you know, when you have a kid that does that, your expectations start to, you know, kind of grow a little bit about, you know, wow, I can't believe he just was like daydreaming right there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you should be honest because you can get hurt. You know, these kids are hitting the ball pretty hard now, you know,
yeah.
So you got to be on your game a little bit. And I got to remember that he's 8, you know, and that, you know, shoot, when I was 8 years old, I think I was still playing T-ball.
Can I tell you something that caught me off guard for her, for being her first time playing? And she loves catching. She loves playing catcher.
Good.
It blows me away. I mean, like, for someone that's never thrown a ball, that's never caught a ball until, you know, a couple months before we got her into it, she always, you know, they rotate positions and stuff, and she's pretty much between left field and catcher. That's her honey hole. She loves catching. She'll volunteer for it. And that takes some guts, too, because you're getting pegged by that ball every time. So
absolutely.
It takes some guts. Now, you know a thing or two about coaching 18-year-olds and stuff. You know, walk me through the end of your year. You guys did win a couple playoff games, and you got up against it was Bedford.
Yeah, we made it to the district finals. You know, with our district, it's a pretty competitive district. We have 6 teams in it, so 4 teams are pretty much guaranteed they're going to be playing a pre-district game on a Tuesday, leading into that district Saturday. So we pulled the pre-district game, and we played against one of our rivals in Gibraltar Carlson. And it was, a big time game, came down to an extra inning, and we ended up winning it, on a walk off, which was nice.
Yeah.
And then, we went to the semifinal against another league opponent in Southgate, and they had a great pitcher going, and, he held us, you know, scoreless for most of the game until around the 5th inning. We, tried to play a little small ball, tried to put a bunt down. And they kind of booted it. They threw it, you know, over the first baseman's head.
Oh,
we were able
man.
To score the one and only run of the game. We ended up winning that game 1-0. Going into the final, we had a lot of confidence going into it.
No, it was the
one
same
of our
day.
Best pitchers on
the semi and the final. Semi and the final is the same day.
Yeah, it's same day. So Bedford ended up beating Wyandotte in the morning game. Which is the 10 a.m. game. We beat Southgate in the noon game. So Bedford had a little bit of a layoff there, which is usually pretty tough to come back from. And we jumped on them early, 1-0. And then sometime around the 4th inning, our pitcher just, you know, I don't know what it was, but he kind of just ran out of gas. He wasn't as sharp and crisp with his pitches, and they ended up scoring 3 runs in that inning, and we were down 3-1. We're still within striking distance because we were hitting the ball. We were just happening to hit the ball right at people. So it was only kind of like a matter of time before, you know, a hit falls in and we score a run or two and we get back into it. And then, you know, sometime, I think it was in the 6th inning, we made an error. They had runners on 1st and 2nd and they bunted. And it went right back to our pitcher. And our pitcher, you know, something that we've practiced, you know, 500 times in practice, you know, throw the ball to third and get the force out right off the bat. He rushed it and, you know, threw the ball away down the third baseline. And, you know, next thing you know, it's 7-1, you know, and of course in the 7th inning, we make a little bit of a comeback. We got bases loaded with nobody out and we ended up scoring 2 runs and, you know, still had runners in scoring position, just couldn't get the guys in.
So then at that point, you start thinking about the runs that came home on your errors and misplays and
oh,
stuff.
Oh, yeah, it was the difference of the game, you know. And that's, you know, that's baseball. You know, that's what I told the kids afterwards. I was like, you know, I want you to understand, you're not playing against the other team. You know, that is what the game is. You're competing against another team. But in reality, you're competing to play the best game that you can possibly play. And, you know, we shot ourselves in the foot. You know, I mean, we made a couple bad pitches, you know, that shouldn't have been made, and they kind of made us pay for it. And then we kicked the ball around a little bit, you know, on a play that, you know, we should make, you know, 99 times out of 100. You know, we booted that play, which cost us a bunch of runs, and really was the difference in the game when it came down to it, you know. We could have, you know, obviously tied the game up 3-3 in that 7th inning if that never happened. So, you know, it is what it is. It's a game of baseball, and it's sometimes, you know, it's a game of inches. Sometimes it's a little bit more than that. And I think in this situation, we didn't play a clean game, and Bedford was a good enough team to take advantage of that. And you know, the team that played the best actually won the game. So that's the way that it goes. They ended up going to the regional and losing to Saline. And Saline ended up winning the state championship for Division I.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. So, I mean, if you're going to lose, you're going to go ahead and kind of start pulling for the team that beat you as long as they got far. And then for them to lose to the state champ, that probably helps cushion the blow. You got a young team?
Well, yeah, we did. We were losing two starters and a role player. So three seniors were losing. Two of them are going on to play college ball. So, you know, those are good impact players that we need to, you know, fill in for. But
where are they going?
We got one's going to Adrian College, and the other one is going to Wright State University. So
nice.
A D3 player and a D1 player.
That'll work.
Yeah, but we're, you know, we kind of restocked. We had a lot. We had a young team. We had four sophomores up. There's a good couple players, you know, in the younger pipeline that we got coming up. So we got two Division I pitchers on our staff coming into this year. You know, one is a senior who is going to Western Michigan on a baseball scholarship, and he just actually had a pro tryout with the Padres the other day. So, I mean, he's getting looked at. He's a big lefty. And then we have another big lefty. He's a junior who has been offered by, you know, probably six or seven Division I schools at this point. But the Michigan State both offered him. Bowling Green, Central, Northwestern, Indiana, and Ohio University. So there's, you know, I mean, he's getting a lot of interest, and it's based on projectability. You know, I mean, sure, he's pretty good now, but, you know, they're thinking 5 years down the road, you know, when he's a senior in their program or a junior, you know, he'll be something special. And so we got two pitchers coming back that are going to be Division I players. So we're on that side of the ball. We're going to be pretty good. We're going to be pretty strong. We got a great core players, you know, core defensive players that are coming back. And, you know, we got some young players coming up. So, you know, it's just a matter of our catcher's coming back. We're going to be strong up the middle again. So, you know, we should have another good year next year. I mean, we're hoping, I think, next year with the mentality of the two D1 pitchers that we have that, you know, there's not going to be a lot of teams that are going to score many runs against us, you know.
Really, so the coaches from these schools, say they commit halfway through the season, how often do you hear from these coaches and them telling you, hey, ease up on his innings, or, you know, watch the pitch count?
Well, yeah, to be honest with you, I haven't had a coach call me to do that. We tend to be conservative with our pitchers. You know, and we've talked about that on previous podcasts, you know, so I think our reputation among most schools in Michigan is that we take care of our guys, and we do a good job with that. We're not going to put them in situations where they can get hurt, and we're not going to overpitch them or overuse them. You know, I have heard it. I mean, there's a kid in our league right now who he's a great young player. He's going to be a senior this year, but he had Tommy John last year and missed the whole season. And he's coming back, and he's already got a scholarship to Michigan State. He's committed, and I'm sure, you know, he's a shortstop / pitcher, and I'm sure in that situation, Michigan State's going to probably, you know, have some influence on if the kid's going to be pitching during the high school season, and if he is pitching, what his pitch count limit will be, and stuff like that. But, you know, high school coaches should follow that, you know, because really, I mean, what we're doing is we're trying to set up these kids to be successful, and, you know, not abuse them. But I've seen it where other coaches have put limits on guys, and high school coaches have kind of blown through those limits. So, you know, I haven't heard anything, but I think, you know, like I said, with our reputation and what we've been doing, you know, we've been doing it kind of the right way. But if a college did come up, you know, a coach came up and said, hey, listen, I want this kid to, you know, his pitch limit to be 70 pitches a game. Okay. Yeah. That sounds good. Next man up, you know, right, when he gets to 70 pitches, someone's going to have to finish this game. So let's develop that, you know, and that's kind of my mentality on it is, you know, let's just get the next guy ready and you know, be ready to go.
I don't know. I kind of feel like that's sitting at the blackjack table and, you know, you want to win money. You want to win money for yourself, and you've got these other guys around you looking how you're playing your hand, and then they think that you're messing up their hand by, you know, taking a card right. that you shouldn't, things like that. So, you know, you got that college coach looking at you like, why would you take a hit when you got that card, you know, when the dealer has that card showing? And but exactly. you're playing your cards. You want to win your hand. And I don't know, it's one of those
catch-22s. And I'll tell you, too, Sal, when I was a younger coach, you know, and the playing my hand and winning the game and being competitive, you know, that did play a factor, you know. But now, you know, I've been coaching for over 10 years now, and to be honest with you, you know, I want to win games, but I want to win games doing it the right way. You know, I think that the lessons are longer lasting when you do it the right way, and you see some success from that process. And I think it's more meaningful, yeah. you know, to the kids, and it is for me too, you know, like I was super competitive. You knew that from growing up, you know? And it was almost obnoxious, you know, in terms of that when I was a younger coach, I would try to hide it from my players that I was really into it. And my heart was racing and all this stuff, you know, but I wanted to win because, you know, I wanted to win, you yeah. know, not, I didn't want my kids, you know, I wasn't thinking in terms of, hey, I want my kids to do it the right way and good things are going to happen and just trust it. And, you know, like you learn that with experience and, you know, a little bit of age on you, get a little wisdom from the game and you get it, you know. So that's what we try to do now is we just try to do everything the right way, the best way that we can, stay consistent with that process, and then the wins will take care of itself. And luckily, you know, that's been the case the last couple of years.
Right. So competitive, you got to coach the All-Star game. How did that
happen? I did.
You know, how did that all come about? That's the coolest thing I've heard. I mean, for you to walk around at Comerica Park, I saw you put the pictures up with your kids and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, how did that all happen?
Well, you know, every year they kind of go over the coaches in the state and who's been doing a good job and who's, you know, experience wise been there, you know, longevity wise. There's a bunch of different criteria that you can go with, but, you know, basically, you know, I'm a younger coach, you know, most of the guys that kind of do it tend to be, you know, 5 or 10 years older than I am. But we've been rather successful the last few years and, you know, I've been highly involved with the Coaches Association and all that stuff. And, you know, they thought, you know, it was time for me to be nominated and selected to coach it. And, you know, it was a very awesome, humbling experience because, you know, you get to be obviously at Comerica, you know, but you get to be around those kids that, you know, they all have that passion. They all have that competitive streak and they've all been doing really well within their own, you know, high school careers. And they're all going on to, you know, big schools, probably most of them, like we had 22 guys on our roster and 16 of them were Division I athletes, wow. You know, so it was just chock full of talent, you know, but it was a cool experience. It was a 2-day event. Day one, we kind of do the meet and greet with the team and have a practice, which was at University Liggett High School in Grosse Pointe. There's a banquet that night, you know, to introduce all the players and the coaches and the Hall of Fame recipients also have their speeches for that night. So it was kind of a cool thing to do it. So, yeah, I got selected and I was able to coach the East team. I was one of, you know, four coaches and got to meet some great people doing it. And it was surreal because I think it was like 2001, maybe 2002. I got to play at Comerica as a player, and that was a cool experience to be able to do that as a player. And then, you know, it kind of comes kind of full circle where you coach. Get to go back and do it as a coach.
So how do you manage a game like that? Are you looking at matchups and lefty righty?
No, no, you don't manage it. You don't manage it all. The one thing, the hardest thing to do is to make sure that all the kids are getting as close to even playing time as possible,
yeah.
You know, because it is an exhibition game, you know, competitive, you know, your competitive fire, it gets going a little bit. And so you do want to win it, but at the same time, it's like, listen, we got 9 pitchers. You guys are each throwing an inning unless you get in trouble. You know, we got these guys, this is the inning you're going to sit. This is the inning. And we just kind of rotate it through, mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes, you know, the biggest thing is because they announced the game, the Tigers announced the game. And there's like a intern or whoever, a communication person in the dugout trying to find out when we make changes who the person's going to be so they can announce it correctly.
Oh, okay.
And that's cool. You know, it gets a little stressful, you know, when you're into the game and then all of a sudden you got to, oh crap, I got to do this. And, you know, I got to hurry up and make this change. And then you got to let this person know so they can radio it up, you know, and make sure that it's on the big screen and, you know, all that other stuff. So it was kind of a cool experience with that. And, you know, it's very humbling because, you know, we put a lot of hard work into, you know, coaching and doing things the right way. And, you know, it's just a little recognition of, you know, that you're doing a good job.
That's awesome.
You know, and my selection to it is really just a reflection of the kids that I've coached, you know, and, you know, I'm extremely thankful and grateful for that.
That's great. I mean, congratulations on all the success and everything this year. I mean, I you know, it's well-deserved. I've known you forever, and, you know, I know you're a hard worker and everything, and, you know, the success in such a short time over at Woodhaven, turning that program around and, you know, being recognized by the state and having to do that. And you guys won, too, that All-Star game, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. Nice. Yeah, it was a good game. I mean, I tell you what, I had one of my players play in it.
Oh, yeah.
Which was, it was the first player that I've had, that I've coached that actually got to play in the game. I had a player that I had coached previously, but it wasn't his senior year. His senior year was when I had to move over to Woodhaven. So he ended up playing in the All-Star game that year, but technically wasn't my player,
right,
playing in the game. But yeah, it was cool to see, you know, Brad out there. That's the guy that was selected from our team to play in it. And, you know, he fit right in. You know, he's a kid that was going to Wright State University. So he fit right in and did a good job and got a hit, a couple RBI. And, you know, it was just fun. It was a fun experience.
So I got to ask you a real hard-hitting question here.
Okay.
I need you to tell me your ultimate stadium meal. I mean, you were just at Comerica. Put together your favorite meal from any stadiums you've ever been to. I know, wow, I just caught you off guard.
Yeah, I tell you what, I'm more of a traditionalist, and I just love the Italian sausages. You know, that's what I do.
What are you putting on there?
Oh, I load them up. You know, onions and peppers, everything. Get them on there, and then I put a little bit of mustard down the side of it, and that's how I eat it.
Beer or pop?
Oh, beer. For sure. Yeah, for sure.
Are you down with Dippin' Dots, or you just love that taste of that taste billowing inside you of that Italian sausage and that garlic and fennel? Just kind of let that fester for a little bit.
Yeah, I like to let it simmer down a little bit.
That's great. I don't know, my favorite stadium meal, I think you can't go wrong with a nacho. I want to get out to L.A., and I want to have a Dodger dog. I mean, everybody lauds these Dodger dogs. You've been to Dodger Stadium, haven't you?
I have, yeah, and I had one. You know, it was good. It did the claim to fame is that the dog is a lot longer than the bun, right? That's what the Dodger dog
is.
And
that's the big deal.
That's the big deal. And it is a good hot dog. I'm not going to lie. It is a good hot dog. Comerica's food is not bad. I mean, I think sometimes we get a little spoiled here, but I go back to Tiger Stadium,
mm-hmm,
you know, and getting a hot dog or Italian sausage there. I mean, that's what you really wanted, you know.
They're so big, and you bite into it, and you got that juice mm-hmm coming at you too. It's like, oh yeah, yeah. It's a good sausage.
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't go to a game where I don't get one. I mean, that's part of the experience for me. If I'm going to go there and drop that kind of money, you better believe I'm getting an Italian sausage with a beer.
Just one, or do you make your way off to the later innings?
Well, it depends on who I'm with. If I'm with the wife, I get one.
Okay.
Because that's the rule. but if I'm by myself or with a buddy of mine, there's a good chance there's two going down. For sure.
Right. Well, it's date night. You got to look good for her, I guess, right?
Well, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Well, date nights are ending if date night was on Sunday because football season's about to start. So how pumped are you for that? It's not even on my radar. The Lions played today, and I'm sitting there flipping through, and there's, you know, I get the alert on my phone. Matthew Stafford finishes 2 for 3, 55 yards. It's like, oh, the Lions were on today. It's not even on my radar.
Well, preseason, you know, I can't stand watching it. I really don't, because you got guys that show up in preseason games 1 and 2 that look phenomenal. And you're like, holy crap, this guy's going to be amazing. And then he doesn't even make the team.
Yeah, you know, well, here we go, Galladay. He caught 2 touchdowns today, and everybody's already freaking out.
What's his name, Galladay or whatever?
Yep, everyone's already freaking out. What a great pickup this is going to be. Stafford's going to have a weapon. He's young. He's this and that. It's like, okay, all right, relax. They played Indy. Relax.
We've heard it, and we've heard that. But, I mean, like I said, there's always the preseason guys that are like, you know, wow, they look like they're going to be the real deal, and then they don't even make the roster.
Zach
preseason,
Zetter.
I'm glad. Listen, football players, I think, need some preseason. I don't think they need 4 games. But I think they need some preseason to kind of get back into the flow of things and the speed of the game. But at the same time, I have no interest in watching this.
Yeah. No, I'm not. That's why I think it's off my radar, too. But maybe you're paying a little bit more attention to it because you're a fantasy football player.
Right. I mean, we do pay a little bit of attention to it. It's more along the injury line and you know, who's going to be where on the depth chart type of thing. So the first 2 preseason games really don't, you know, for us, we don't really pay much attention to it. The third one's kind of a big one, you know, so we can get, you know, if there's any kind of jockeying for depth chart positions, you know, we need to know that. So, but most, I'm going to be honest with you, most of us try to draft towards the end of the preseason so that, you know, all those things are kind of already decided on and you have the most information that is most up to date.
You haven't done any drafts yet?
No, our draft is going to be September 2nd. We're going to do it over Labor Day weekend.
Okay. Do you do a live draft, or do you guys get all together? How do you guys do that?
Yeah, we get together. We do it in person. We've done it in the past where it's been all online, but you know, we're all married and stuff like that now with kids, so any excuse to kind of get out and have a couple beers with your buddies, that's what we do. So,
how many laptops tablets do you have in front? How many laptops and tablets do you have in front of you when you're drafting and magazines?
it's pretty funny actually. Usually I have one iPad and a magazine. That's usually what I do, but because I share the team with another guy, of course. So he's got another magazine on top of that, and this year we'll probably have 2 electronic devices. He's usually on his phone. He's pretty quick with that. And I have an iPad. And we have a couple magazines, but you know, it's just, again, I mean, we can get into the draft stuff, but, you know, for us, it's just trying to get the most up-to-date information possible, right. You know?
So when you're looking at draft positioning and things like that, and a lot of them, what's it called? The snake draft or the
yeah.
S? Yeah.
Yeah.
So when, a lot of guys that go 1, 2, 3, they're mostly running backs. And it's funny because the NFL has switched away from a running league to a throwing league. But you've always got your, you know, it was Jamal Charles and it was David Johnson. And you've got that Top Gun and Le'Veon Bell, you know, those top running backs that are always right there, 1, 2, 3. Why is a running back still so important?
Because it's not a very deep position. You know, and I think... And I do think the strategy changes a little bit once that top tier, you know, group of running backs switch up, you know, the Zekes of the world, you know, the David Johnsons, like you mentioned, Le'Veon Bells, you know, the guys that are generally the old school running back where they get, you know, they're on the field for 3 downs, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of the new hybrid way that they do things where you have your running down back and then you have your 3rd down back that comes in and he's a threat to catch a ball and run it, you know, the Theo Riddicks of the world.
The Theo Riddick package.
What's that?
The Theo Riddick package.
Exactly, yeah, you know. But those are becoming more and more popular, so you mean you have to draft those guys now, you know.
Right.
But if you are, you know, in the top 4 or 5 picks and, you know, that you're probably going to go running back, mainly because, you know, after those 4 or 5 guys, everybody's kind of splitting time, you know, and it's hit and miss on who's going to be, you know, I think of the Atlanta Falcons last year, you know, you had Tevin Coleman and you had Devontae Freeman. In the beginning of the year, no one really knew who was going to be the guy that was going to break out.
Right.
They didn't know if it was going to be Freeman or if it was going to be, you know, Tevin Coleman because he can catch the ball out of the backfield and he's doing all these things. And then all the, you know, nobody really knew. So those 1st 5 picks, you try to go after those, you know, the old school APs of the world, the guys that are going to run the ball 25 times a game.
Right.
And going to be out there on 3rd down. Now, after that, It depends on the league. If you're a PPR league, point per reception, or like in our league, we do a half a point per reception, you might see some receivers go. Because of the passing thing and the number of receptions, guys like Julian Edelman, who could, you know, go out there and catch 10 balls for 75 yards,
right.
You know, there's a lot of point value to that. So you see a lot of receivers. Antonio Brown will be the first receiver to go, more than likely. You know, but then you'll see a couple quarterbacks. Last year, we actually drafted Cam Newton in the first round because of the year before he was a dual threat. He threw for, you know, close to 4,000 yards, and he ran for 1,000 yards, you know, right. And scored like 12 rushing touchdowns, which is 6 points, whereas a passing touchdown is 4. Mm-hmm. So we're like, oh, we're going to draft him. I think we had the 6th spot, and we drafted him 6th, and he was a total bust.
Yeah.
The whole year. Now, we backed him up with Matt Ryan, who ended up being the number one quarterback in our league, which was good, but then we sacrificed other positions. So, like, our running back situation wasn't good. You know, it wasn't good at all. So this year we have the 8th pick, and we do the snake draft. So, you know, we'll have 2 picks within, you know, what is that, 8, 9, 10, 11, and then coming back down with that 11th and 12th pick, we'll be right there. So, you know, hopefully we'll get better value, you know, at that level, but we won't get any of those big time running backs, unless possibly if Ezekiel Elliott drops to us.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because the suspension came down and it's 6 games. But yeah, looking at the rookie year that he had last year, and usually guys like that will take a step up their second year. I'm expecting Dak and I'm expecting Zeke to have big years this year. But 6 games, that's, you know, considering that a fantasy league playoffs and championship go to week 16, you know, week 15, yep. You're losing a good portion of your season betting on a guy if you're going to draft him that high. How do you think that's going to impact drafts all over the place?
Well, I mean, if you look at his schedule, he's got a bye, I believe, week 6, which means that if the 6-game suspension holds up, he won't be playing until week 8. And that's significant, you know. So, you know, you got to look into that and decide for yourself on what you want to do. Personally, like Le'Veon Bell last year was suspended 4 games, and everybody thought, okay, well, he's going to drop, you know, someone picked him up with like the 4th or 5th pick anyway, and he still ended up finishing in the top 4 in running back points.
Right.
So it worked out, you know, but you better hope that you can withstand the first 4 games of the season. I mean, you know, you start a fantasy season off 0-4, you could be all right still. You know, that guy comes back and you go on a little bit of a run. That's entirely possible. But you start the season 0-6, 0-7 because of, you know, the Ezekiel Elliott thing, because you drafted him number 3 overall because you thought, you know, the appeal was going to go through and he'd only get 4 games. Well, say they hold it up. Well, now you better hope, you know, your season can be over by the time he comes back.
Exactly.
So the impact I think that's going to have is, you know, I think someone in my league will take him in the first round still. Because there's some guys that just they believe in that.
Where did Brady go last year?
I think he's going to go 3rd round. I think in most drafts he's going 3rd round. But I've seen a couple mock drafts where he's gone early 2nd round. You know, the guy, maybe he's got the 10th pick and he's got the bookends, so he goes, you know, running back first and then picks Zeke on the 2nd one.
Yeah.
And so now, you know, now when he comes back, he's probably going to have to go receiver, quarterback. And then fill in with some running backs towards the end of it on the backside of the draft. I can see that.
Where did Brady go last year with his suspension?
In our league, I believe he was 2nd round still, 2nd or 3rd round. You know, he's rated the number 2 quarterback going into this year, but, you know, even though he's like 40 years old and Matt Ryan had a great year last year, he's still rated I might say higher than Matt Ryan is, but, you know, with that suspension, it was weird because the guy that took him, when he drafted him, we all kind of, you know, we were like, oh, my God, we can't believe you took him there. But, you know, at the end of the year, he's in the playoffs, and he made it work, you know. So I think with the quarterback position, you can probably take a risk like that. Not that you need to, because it's kind of a deep position. After, you know, the 2 or 3 guys that are always in, you know, always up there throwing close to 5,000 yards. After that, then there's, you know, everybody's, you know, about the same, and it's just about scheduling and strength of schedule.
So you take an Ezekiel Elliott knowing that he's going to be gone for so long, or a Tom Brady. At that point, do you take a, you know, we already mentioned him, but a Theo Riddick-type third down back to kind of put a Band-Aid over it? Or do you maybe hope for a good running back left on the waiver wire or the, you know, free agents?
You do two things. Number one, if you're drafting Ezekiel Elliott, you better draft DeMarco Murray. Or excuse me, not DeMarco Murray, his backup. Who's his backup? Jerry McFadden, sorry. Mm-hmm. Murray was a couple years ago. You better draft McFadden. Now, McFadden is injury prone, but the year before Zeke got there, he still rushed over 1,000 yards in full-time status. So he still got it, you know, and he didn't obviously run the ball a ton last year because Zeke was there and did a great job. So he's fresh. With Dak Prescott back there, being able to throw and kind of adding the running element to it, I think McFadden could be a huge pickup. So you better handcuff Zeke with McFadden, number one, if you're going to do that. Number two, then yes, I think you need to go out and you need to get one of those third down backs, a Theo Riddick or like a poor man's Darren Sproles or something like that, where, you know, on any given day, you know, this person could, you know, get three receptions for 95 yards and a touchdown. You know, I mean, that is the toughest. That's why you see so many of these offenses going to these, you know, these screen plays. You know, there's more screens being run with running backs and wide receivers than ever before because they're hard to defend, you know. So these third down backs, I think, you know, they have a distinct advantage, and I definitely think you need to try to scoop one of them up if you go Zeke, because, you know, they can come in and you're banking on them having a decent game. If they can get you 10 points, great. You know, that'd be awesome. But those third down backs could get you 2 points, or they can get you 40 points, depending on the type of game they have. You know, so I definitely think you handcuff them with McFadden, but you try to get one of those, you know, the Theo Riddick type running back to sub in.
So they traded Sammy Watkins today.
Buffalo
traded Watkins today. Something like that, where he's going to be, you know, he's going to be one of the top receivers taken. Now he's moving conferences, he's moving coasts because he's going to L.A. New quarterback, rookie quarterback, well, second-year quarterback. Does that hurt him, help him?
Absolutely. No, it hurts him. I think his value goes down considerably. You know, somebody might take a chance on him still around the round that he should be going, but I think it hurts them because, number one, L.A. was such a bad team last year that, you know, their running game wasn't very good. You know, their quarterback situation, it's not a great situation for him to be in there. Now, do I think he's going to be an absolute complete bust? No, I think he's going to be, you know, I think he's going to be utilized quite a bit. But you also might see him getting
overutilized.
You know, exactly.
I mean, he's going to be Jared Goff's security blanket because you'd mentioned it. If they're not going to get much from Gurley, he's going to be throwing the ball a lot. And if they can't protect Goff, Goff's just going to start slinging it to his safety net, and it's going to be him, which he's going to be double covered because he's going to be the only weapon. So that's definitely going to
exactly. So you never really know. I mean, some games he might break out. If he's not being double covered and he's the safety blanket, well, then, you know, at that point, he's probably going to have a really good game. If he is being double covered and, you know, L.A. can't get the running game going with Gurley, then they're going to be hurting, you know. And you'll see a bunch of games with Sammy Watkins where he's got 2 points. And, you know, then some defense will decide that they're going to get kind of crazy and not double team him. And he might burn him for, you know, 25 points.
Right.
You know, and that's the inconsistency that you don't want to see. In fantasy football, you want to see the guy that is consistently getting you, you know, 7-8 receptions, close to 100 yards, and possibly a touchdown.
And he's going
That's
to
what
a
you're
tough
looking
division,
for.
Too. I mean, the division he's going, he's got Seattle's defensive backs and Arizona's defensive backs. Sure, he gets to play the Niners twice a year, but, I mean, he has to play those other guys 4 times a year. That's definitely got to hurt. As a fantasy, you know, fantasy guy, you got to look at so much. I mean, scheduling, you have to look at away games, home games, where they're playing in the wintertime, and defensive matchups and everything. I mean, it's you're a general manager at that point. How big do your balls get when you're in first place riding high and thinking to yourself, I could do this? Do you ever have a guy, do you ever run across a guy saying, I could do a better job than these GMs?
Oh, yeah. There's well, I mean, I think every fan, you know, who's watched the Tigers this year, has been in that situation, screaming at the TV or watching the Twitter updates go by, and saying they could do a better job than that, you know. But I think, you know, fantasy football, I think guys, you know, for the most part, you know, it's an ego thing for some guys because it's competitive. But, you know, to be honest with you, it's still fantasy football. Like, you're not going based on who scores the most points over the course of the season. You're still going head-to-head, which is going to be luck. I might score 150 points one week, but the team that I happen to be playing scores 151, and I was the number two team on the week, but I got the loss. Whereas these other teams that might have scored 75, 76 points a game and won, you know, they have a better record now. You know, and that happened to us last year where we were like top five in scoring and didn't make the playoffs. Wow. We missed out, you know, and a team that was like 8 or 9 in scoring made the playoffs and actually made a pretty deep run. So, you know, there's still that, you know, that sense of you don't really know what's going to happen because it's still a crapshoot. You know, it depends on the luck of your schedule, who you play, you know, what you're the guy that you're playing, what kind of matchups does he have on his team, and you can't really control that. So the only thing that you can do is just try to make sure that you have the most consistent high-scoring team that you can and hope that, you know, on any given week that it works out the way it's supposed to.
How much of a hero is Matthew Stafford in fantasy because of the garbage time yards that he gets?
Well, I wouldn't use the word hero, but I would say that it puts him in the tier two quarterback talk where, you know, I think you could get good value if you select him, you know, in the later rounds, fifth or sixth, seventh round, where, you know, I think his stats and points will be comparable to a lot of the high-end tier two guys. So, you know, like I said, once you get out of the, you know, the Drew Brees, the Aaron Rodgers, even the Tom Brady's of the world, and you get into even you can throw Matt Ryan up there because of the year that he had. Not that I think that he's going to have that exact type of year this year. I think it's going to be a little bit more tougher sledding for him. But I think he's going to have a good year. Their stats are all, you know, comparable. Stafford is just, to me, a poor man's Brett Favre. And, you know, I thought last year he played I thought he had a good year last year. I really did. I think he's a bright spot in an organization that doesn't have very many bright spots. You know what I mean? So, talent-wise, I think he is right there with the best of them. But I will say this, the comparisons to Jay Cutler now, you know, Stafford needs to kind of win. You know, he needs to start winning and making playoffs because Jay Cutler for years was said, he's got all the talent in the world. He can do this, he can do that, he can make every throw. And every year his team was awful. You know what I mean?
Right.
And now he has another chance in Miami, which is ridiculous.
With Adam Gase. He had a Pro Bowl year in Chicago with Adam Gase.
Yep. I still don't put that much stock in that situation. I know people do, and they talk about it, and they're like, all that connection. It could maybe Cutler can come. Listen, Cutler had to be talked off the couch by his girlfriend, you know, or his, I don't know if it's his wife or his girlfriend.
No, they're married, yeah.
But my God, like, hey, get off your ass and go play football because you're like 28. You know what I mean? Like,
he wanted to go into broadcasting. He's 28 years old. And I have a good feeling that, you know, once Kristen Cavallari heard that it was Miami calling, she's like, we can do that for the winter. No problem.
For $10 million? Like, 1 year,
well, that's
million
what I'm seeing, too. Like, Cutler, I mean, the guy universally has been roasted his last couple seasons, and they're going to throw him $10 million.
And Kaepernick is still out there. That's the thing that cracks me up. But I get why Kaepernick doesn't have a job. I mean, you wear a Castro shirt down in Miami, you're not probably going to get a job considering that they have such a Cuban presence down there.
Right.
So in that situation, you're kind of a moron. I get it. Or his girlfriend tweeting out about the Baltimore Ravens owner, you know, those types of things are what don't get you jobs. You know, I mean, that keeps you from being employed.
It parallels in real life too. You definitely got to watch your social media presence, you know, as a teacher.
Sure.
You know, or if you're going on job interviews, what's out there that people can look at and be like, oh, really? Okay, well, never mind. You know, and a guy like Kaepernick, too. If Ray Rice, this goes back to everything that happened a couple of years ago with the domestic abuse and all the violence that was happening then. If Ray Rice was a little bit bigger and younger, he'd have had a job. If Colin Kaepernick was able to perform, he'd have a job. But if you look, if you start looking at his stats and, you know, his win-loss record and his performance over the last, you know, couple of years of his career, there's nothing that teams want to invest in. So not only that, but then the circus that he would bring, the media attention that he would bring to a team for bringing him on board, that's going to take away.
Most of those owners and GMs would have a little bit more leeway with a guy like Colin Kaepernick if he was playing like Michael Vick.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you get what I'm saying? Like, right. If he was a superb talent and he could make all the throws and he was making good decisions, you know, like Michael Vick was towards the end of his career.
Right.
And he was, you know, he's supremely talented. He's an athletic guy, you know. Then, yeah, they would take a chance. But nobody's going to take a chance on a guy like that who brings so much baggage to be a backup quarterback.
Right.
Like,
exactly.
Yes, he is better than probably 99% of the backup quarterbacks that are out there.
To hear that Miami was going to reach out to Tim Tebow and not Colin Kaepernick, I mean, that was kind of and that you want to talk about sideshow Tim Tebow brings. That's a sideshow in and of itself. But again,
you know what, though? Here's my thing. The sideshow that Tim Tebow brings – yeah, I think for the vast majority of it, the media has blown it way out of proportion.
Yes, no, I agree with you.
You know, and I think it's such a like they've turned a positive thing into a negative thing.
Well, I want to go on the record before you go in. I love Tim Tebow. I mean, on Instagram, that always pops up, you know, Tim Tebow leaves the on-deck circle to go shake an autistic kid's hand. You know, Tim Tebow stands next to the girl, you know, with cerebral palsy singing the national. That guy is a tremendous human being. And he's in minor league ball, and he hits the ball. I mean, he got up to Port St. Lucie, and he started hitting the ball. So he's an athlete. Yep. He's athletic. So, yeah, the guy is very religious. The guy's very humble. The guy is outspoken about his beliefs, and he gets roasted for it. Colin Kaepernick, outspoken about his beliefs, roasted for it. You know, one you can be viewed as negative, one can be viewed as positive. But these are the things that teams have to contend with when they're looking
Listen, when you look at Tim Tebow, should still be in the NFL. You know, are you telling me that a guy that could lead the Denver Broncos to a playoff win over the Pittsburgh Steelers, and can first of all get the Denver Broncos to the playoffs to be able to win that game, is not better than any of the backups that are in the league currently? Now, I know most teams keep two quarterbacks, and back in the day they were keeping three. Some teams do that still, but most teams keep two. Are you telling me that Tim Tebow isn't as good? Like, that's the thing that cracks me up about that situation, is that I understand that there is a really close parallel between Kaepernick and Tebow. And when you look at it, they're, like you said, they're both kind of outspoken about their beliefs. One is more of a religious thing, and the other one's more of like a social cause type of thing.
Yep.
But then you have to start wondering, like, all right, well, is race really an issue in that situation like it's been portrayed to be, when both of those guys have, quote-unquote, kind of been blackballed in the game? You know what I mean? Tim Tebow couldn't find a job. He was desperate to get a job. He couldn't find a job. The dude was a supreme athlete. Can't find one.
He got Kaepernick in his own way, too. I think Tebow got in his own way, too, where he insisted on playing quarterback. When there were teams out there that were offering him fullback, tight end, all these different positions. And look, the guy realized he had a nice gig with ESPN. He had a nice gig on ABC. What was it, Good Morning America? Yeah. And he went and played baseball. So he's like, I want to play quarterback. I'm a quarterback. This is what I'm going to do. I can parlay this, or I can play quarterback, or I have my you know, all these other resources available to me as well. Where he took advantage.
But listen,
of that.
The controversy here for me is, well, why can't he play quarterback? Why doesn't a team want him to play quarterback? And you can go into passing percentage or completion percentage and all that stuff. Here's the deal. The spokesman of your team, the guy that gets interviewed the most on your football team, the face of your franchise, is your starting quarterback, right? Whether it's Tom Brady, who is, you know, super blasé in his interviews and blah, 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 or it's like Kirk Cousins, right? That's the face of your franchise, is your quarterback, especially in this quarterback-driven league. So the message that Tebow was carrying with him, and the hoopla that was following him from place to place, was always on center stage because he was in that quarterback position. Okay. Right. Now, would it be that way if he was like a backup somewhere? Probably not. Nobody really wants to hear from the backup quarterback. Or if he had moved to a fullback position, you know, how many times have you seen a fullback get interviewed? You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
It's like, it doesn't happen. Yeah, you know, so I get why they wanted to move him out of there, but part of that is not just the talent part of it. There's the PR part of it.
Yeah, but I mean, PR can only drive so much if you're not winning and you're not completing passes and, you know, and throwing touchdowns.
I agree. Listen, I agree, but it wasn't like Tebow wasn't winning. Like, he was winning. Like, his winning percentage, I believe, is over 50% in the NFL. And you got guys that have good jobs right now that are starting whose winning percentages are in the 30s.
Yeah.
And that's the Kaepernick situation, is because even though Kaepernick's stats weren't all that great, at one time he was leading teams to win. You know, he was a quarterback of a winning team. I believe it was when Harbaugh was there, they made it to the the NFC Championship game? Or no, they actually made it to the Super Bowl.
They were 5 yards away from winning it, 7 yards right. or something like that.
You know, and so you know that guy has that ability. Right? He just needs, you know, maybe a little bit more coaching, a little bit more time to kind of find that again, or just an opportunity, you know?
I definitely think there's a coaching thing there with Kaepernick. I mean, you saw the whole organization fall apart after Harbaugh left. And by the way, thank you, San Francisco. I will thank you every day for that, because you can see what impact he had on Michigan.
Absolutely.
So there's definitely coaching into that.
There are some guys that, no matter where they go, they are able to change the culture. And Harbaugh did that in San Francisco, and he's obviously done it in Michigan. Now, you know, obviously they came out and said that he's the most overrated college football coach in the nation. There was an article that came out and said that. And I'm okay with that, because that just proves the fact that, you know, there's people out there that still doubt the success that he's had in Michigan.
Right.
You know, that, oh, well, you should win it every year because you had this many guys drafted. It's like, dude, there's other teams out there.
Those weren't his guys.
You know, there's the Alabamas of the world that, you know, they had four first-round picks off of their team.
Yep. ESPN had an article today, article that I saw today was, this is Harbaugh's team. Like, these are his guys now, his sophomores and his juniors. So you're going to see the caliber of talent that this guy has. All these players that Brady Hoke recruited and Harbaugh got to be NFL stars, Hoke wasn't going to get Taco Charlton to the NFL. Hoke wouldn't have known what to do with these guys. Harbaugh did. Right. So now you've got Harbaugh's guys coming in. What is he, you know, what does that mean? Yeah, Ohio State, and, you know, people are all in love with Penn State now. I'm sorry, the cream of the crop is still Ohio State, and then Michigan is right there nipping at their heels. They were a misspotted fourth down run away from beating Ohio State in the shoe last year. Actually, it was the play before that where they lost that game. That guy scrambled for 100 yards side to side.
Yes.
You know, a bunch of garbage. But anyway, we're digressing a little bit. You brought up Pittsburgh, you know, Tebow beating Pittsburgh. That's one of the most intriguing draft picks that I hear about, is defense. You know, when do you take a defense? You know, obviously Pittsburgh, Baltimore, Arizona, you know, those are kind of the better defenses you always hear about. When's the right time? And who's usually the first team taken off the board?
Yeah, it's a good question. Again, it goes down to value. You know, for what I look at is this. There's probably five top-tier defenses in the league, maybe four. I mean, you can kind of throw the Vikings in there, maybe. But I would say, like, the Broncos, the Seahawks, the Texans, and the Chiefs are the top four that – I think are scoring defenses, because you're looking for teams that are going to be able to run back punts. They're going to run back kickoffs, you know, teams that can get points that way as well. The tier two, you know, defenses that you're looking at, like the Vikings, you can throw the Cardinals in there. They can even be kind of, like I said, one of those tier one guys, the Patriots, even the Panthers, you know, you just need to find, a defense that has a good schedule against subpar quarterbacks. And you're usually going to be pretty good. Honestly, what I would do is I'm thinking like probably the eighth or ninth round. You know, I think you can start getting some of those defenses in there. Some guys go earlier than that. You know, they'll pick up, if the Broncos are going to be, you know, the stud defense, they'll pick them up you know, probably in the seventh round, you know. But I usually don't do that unless I know it's going to be an absolute for sure thing where they're going to just score a bunch of touchdowns, you know, on the defensive side of it. You know, like Alabama last year, right?
Yep.
Alabama's, you know, they just scored, they would score a touchdown every game.
Mm-hmm.
Their defense would, you know, like if you had a pro defense that, you know, that was going to score a bunch of touchdowns, then maybe you go somewhere in the seventh round. But for the most part, you know, defenses, it's hit and miss, you know, it kind of depends on the game and the scheme and, you know, who's going to do what, you know? So yeah, some guys stream defenses, you know, they won't waste a high draft pick on it. They'll go like 10th, 11th, 12th round. They'll pick a defense up and then they'll stream it week to week. They'll just get the best defense with the best matchup, so, you know, and they'll do it that way.
So that's another thing too, is, you know, waiver wire. I mean, that's gotta be important. Obviously, if you get a guy that gets injured, or if you get a guy that's suspended, or if you get a bad matchup or whatever the case may be, positions like defense and positions like kicker, is that something that you would do like on a week to week? You know, who's this guy kicking
for sure.
against? Would
you, no, absolutely.
So have you ever drafted a kicker, or do you just do that?
Oh, yeah, I've drafted kickers. I mean, Janikowski for years was a guy that was always going to be one of the leaders. Well, he probably was the leader in terms of field goal points. So, you know, you would definitely draft a guy like that. There's been quite a few. Vinatieri was one of those guys. There's kickers out there now that, you know, you definitely should draft. But once you get out of like the Justin Tuckers of the world, the Gostkowskis, the Baileys, you know, those type of guys, then, you know, there's some like tier two guys that you can get. But then after that, you know, you're basically just, you know, streaming them week to week, you know, depending on how they're doing. And there's going to be a kicker at some point who is not drafted that sometime around week three or four, you're going to see someone pick them up. You know, not because he's a you know, a simple buy replacement, but he's a guy that is now scoring a ton of points. Maybe he's kicking three or four field goals a game and he hasn't missed an extra point type of thing. Now you're in a situation where like, wow, this guy is actually putting up a lot of points.
The one year I played, this is the most recent year, this is the last time, I retired as a champion. So at Drew Brees and Colston led me to that championship, but my running back was Matt Forte. And I remember Forte got hurt. And I'm looking at the waiver wire. I'm like, well, what the hell do I do? And I kind of looked at the Washington Redskins, and they had Roy Helu. I didn't know who the hell Roy Helu was. I'd known that he had been decent. So I picked him up off the waiver wire for the playoffs. And I won the league with Roy Helu. So there's definitely fines at the end of the year. You know, can you give me an example? This is always something that I think about, too. A good fantasy player versus a good player in real life, or like a bad fantasy player who's a good fantasy, you know, a good in real life player. Like, is there something that correlates? Like, yeah, he may be really good, but he's not a good fantasy player. You mentioned Edelman gets a ton of receptions. If you're not in a PPR, he's not that good of a fantasy player.
Right. And it depends on how your league is set up too. Cause there's some guys like a Ted Ginn, right, who doesn't get a lot of receptions, but usually the ones he does get are like a 65-75 yard touchdown, and you get bonus points for those. So, you know, you kind of do have to look into, you know, what's their average touchdown play, find out where it's at, what's going on, because you got some guys that are like, you know, those are the ones that are always catching those really long passes for touchdowns. So those guys, you know, are decent fantasy players because of the bonus points, but they're probably not that big of impact players in terms of a game because they're probably catching that touchdown in garbage time more than likely,
right.
You know? So there are examples of that. You know, Ted Ginn is one, you know, that you can look at, you know, going into this year, you know, there's Duke Johnson. He's a running back for Cleveland. I think he's a guy that is a pretty good player for Cleveland. I think, you know, that he can potentially, you know, win that job, and that job could be his, and he could be an every down back. But fantasy wise, he's garbage. You know, I mean, he just doesn't get enough. You know, does he help his team win? Yeah, he helps his team, well, be competitive for a while until the defense gives it all up. But, you know, he's the kind of guy that is a good player. He's got some talent, but fantasy wise, he has absolutely no value.
What would you ever do a quarterback wide receiver combo, would you take Eli Manning and Odell Beckham, same team?
Sure. Absolutely. I think, you know, we've done that in the past. I had a Jordy Nelson and Aaron Rodgers hookup a couple years ago, which was nice because, like you said, anything over a 50-yard touchdown in our league has a bonus attached to it, both for the quarterback and the receiver. So you're double-dipping on your points. That's great when they're doing well. When they're in a game where they don't do anything, you got two players that are starting in your lineup that are doing nothing. Okay. And that can be frustrating.
Kind
so
of a high risk, high reward.
It's a very high risk, high reward type of thing. And if you have a guy like Jordy Nelson and Aaron Rodgers, then it's a pretty good thing. A Tom Brady, Gronkowski, type thing. It's pretty good. Or back in the day when it was Brady and Moss, obviously that was the hookup of all hookups.
What a year.
You wanted to make sure you had that. Tony Romo and Des Bryant. I mean, you kind of want to put those guys together. Now, I wouldn't draft Eli Manning as my first quarterback just because I have Odell Beckham. That's something I would not do. But if I had like an Aaron Rodgers and I knew that coming back I could get a Jordy Nelson, then I would do that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's to me, I look at that, if you've got that back-to-back, or do you think to yourself, okay, let me get this quarterback and see if a Jordy Nelson falls so I can pick up a running back or I can pick up another receiver from another team? Or if you identify that right away, would you just pick it up and just do it on that return?
I think it depends on the value of it. You know, like if you think they're going to be – if you can get a top five or six quarterback and a top five or six wide receiver and they're on the same team and you can draft them back-to-back, you should do it. You know, I mean, that seems like a no-brainer to me, you know.
Yeah.
But if it's like an Eli Manning and an Odell Beckham, where Beckham could finish in the top five in receiving, but Manning's probably somewhere around top, you know, 13, top 12 type of thing, then, you know, that situation, you might want to go to another position. The other thing, too, is you don't want to have too many guys, obviously, on the same team because they all have the same bye.
Right.
You know, and then that's basically a week that you're going to try to piece together your whole team, and more than likely you're going to lose. So.
Two starters off the board. You ever been a commissioner?
I have been a commissioner, yeah. I'm not the commissioner of this year, but I have in my own league before. It gets complicated because it gets so competitive. You got so much money going through people's hands that, you know, you want to make sure that it's a fair and equitable you know, draft policy and a league rule system. And, but there's always things that pop up that are just weird, you know, and I don't want that kind of stress.
What, have you ever blocked trades or have you seen any collusion with a team that's out of the playoffs and then trying to get their best players to a guy that's in the playoffs because they're buddies or something?
Yeah, but that's why I think initially they put the trade deadline in so that you can only make trades up through like week 9 or something like that. But, you know, yeah, there's been some situations where a team has been, you know, completely out of it, mathematically eliminated by week 9. And then a team that's, you know, right there and they make a trade and you're like, wow, that doesn't make any sense. You know, why would that happen? But what we used to get was we used to get them blocked. People would vote on them right then and there and block them, you know. And if more than half the league blocked your trade – on the voting, then the trade didn't go through. But what it got down to was everybody was just arguing why, what's the merit of the trade and this, that, and the other thing. It's like, all right, this is what we're going to do. You know, there's 10 of us. We're all buddies. We all have a lot of money riding on the line. If someone thinks that someone's doing that, that's going to be a conversation we have to have. And if that's the case and we kind of feel that way, we'll talk about it and that person won't be asked back.
Right. That's it.
You know, but like I play with, you know, I mean, a lot of guys, you know, the Scotty Brooks, Big John, Rick, you know, Thorning, you know, a lot of those guys. So we've all known each other a really long time. And, you know, with the exception of one or two guys that's in the league, we've all been friends for well over 10 years or if not more. So, you know, it's we don't really have those issues too much.
Wow. Anything ever get heated where you've lost a friend or anything like that?
Yes.
Happen? Yeah.
I'm going to tell you that right now. It wasn't football. It was fantasy baseball. And the situation was I was the one that got pissed. But so we did the draft. We were doing a keeper league for the very first year. It was the same 10 guys for like 5 years. And we were all buddies. We played poker together, stuff like that. So we decided, you know what, we're all going to be here, so let's just start doing a keeper. So we did, right? And my keeper was Albert Pujols. Okay, this was like when he was still, you know, the mecca of the mecca, right? He was the guy. So I kept Albert Pujols, which meant that I was going to lose my first round pick for the next draft. However, I got the number one overall pick, which means that I have the number one overall pick in the second round. Excuse me. Yeah, the second round. So that meant that I was going to be that guy. I was going to be the first pick of the second round, which is basically getting another first round talent, since the vast majority of keepers were first rounders from the year before. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that goes into the situation. We write it up. We do the draft, which was completely random from the site. We were doing through CBS Sports at the time, and everything was working out. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the commissioner at the time, someone complained about something, and it turned into, oh, well, we're just going to redo the order, the draft order. And I got on there, and I'm like, why are we redoing the draft order? This doesn't make any sense. And, of course, it came out because I had Albert Pujols, and I got the number one pick, which was completely random, that they thought that was unfair. And I'm like, it's random, dude. Like, whether it was you don't think it was good or it's going to be bad for you, that doesn't matter. Yeah, right. You know, it's still random and it was fair. And we got in this big old thing, dude. It was like, I was done. You know, I said my piece. I'm like, this is ridiculous. And the commissioner at the time, you know, just was like, well, you know, these guys really want us to do it. I know it screws your team, but, you know, I think we're just going to have to do it. And I'm like, well, then find somebody else.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got out of the league.
Is Mike Trout the number one pick in baseball's fantasy draft?
He should be.
Or Bryce Harper.
Yeah. No, I think it should be Mike Trout, although I think, did you see Bryce Harper's
injury last night? That was so ugly. It was gross.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
It was disgusting.
I mean, they're underplaying this, a deep bone bruise. Corey, you've shredded your knee a time or two.
Yeah.
There's more than a bone bruise going on, right?
Well, that's what I thought initially. And then the doctors came out, the Nationals, and they do the field testing of it, right, where they shift the knee, the top and the bottom of the knee, to see if how much play and how much leeway is in there.
Right.
And they said initially that it looked like a torn ECL and a torn PCL. Now that's big time, because you nowadays you can tear an ACL, and, you know, as long as you don't have any other structural damage, you should be in good shape, especially those guys that have the best of the best rehab and all that stuff, blah, blah, blah. You know, they could come back and it won't be much of an issue. But when you tear two ligaments, it adds a little bit of a wrinkle to that rehab. But they're coming out and saying that their MRI this morning came out and it was clean. Like, there was no structural damage. There's just a deep bone bruise, and he should be expected back at some point. You know, just because the ligament's there, you know, the other thing too is, well, maybe the ligament's there and it's intact, but did it stretch out?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Is there more play in that knee now than there was before? Is that going to affect them? I mean, is that going to be a higher risk of injury leading forward?
Yeah, it was definitely hyperextended. I mean, you can tell that it was gross. Again, it was ugly, and I didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen some ugly things. You know, bones going through skin, and Joe Theismann, yes, and all those guys, and, you know, that receiver from Houston against Marshall.
Yeah.
If you want to YouTube that one and watch that guy going through the bands cart, that's gross. But man, when watching that guy's leg come down on first base. And just the collective hush over an entire city, of an entire league, because that's one of their – he's MVP. He's the MVP so far. And, you know, that's brutal.
He's the face of, you know, like it or not, he is the face of Major League Baseball.
Oh, without a doubt.
Mike Trout is, you know, the West Coast version of that, and Bryce Harper's the East Coast. And,
right.
I mean, they complement each other perfectly in that situation. Yeah. But I would say, honestly, Bryce Harper – probably has higher upside in terms of fantasy potential than Mike Trout, to be honest with you, just because of the sheer number of home runs, the RBIs, the runs scored, you know, the plays that he makes. I mean, he gets after it. He goes on hot streaks like none other. Trout is just more really consistent, and part of his, you know, his lure is the war stat and the defensive stuff that he does. And offensively, though, they're 1A and 1B.
Yeah.
You know,
that's another, maybe this might be a whole podcast in and of itself, but, you know, you mentioned it. The East Coast has Bryce Harper. The West Coast has Mike Trout. Yet Major League Baseball continues to lose their fan base, continues to lose the youth. You know, you've got two fresh, young, marketable, talented faces. The NBA had Magic and Bird. And look where that league went from there. How come baseball can't do that? I mean, that's, to me, it kills me because I love baseball. I love that my daughter's been playing baseball. We can sit down and watch a game now. But, you know, it's very regional. And to be able to capitalize on names like that, you know, ride the momentum. Well, the Cubs won the World Series. That was a huge deal. Now put these faces everywhere. You know, their national baseball contract. What are we watching tonight? Sox Yanks. What were we watching a couple weeks ago? Sox Yanks. You got to put Trout and Harper out there as much as you can.
No, I agree. I think Major League Baseball, instead of, you know, they don't do what the NBA does, right? You know, the NBA goes after individual players and try to match them up against other great individual players. And a lot of times in the NBA, that means their teams are pretty good too, you know? In baseball, it's not the case, right? So they just go, you know, well, this has huge implications. The Yanks, Red Sox, you know, the Yankees are trailing the Red Sox by 4.5 games and this, that, and the other thing, and this series can mean something. And then those are the games that they play. So Major League Baseball's philosophy is just a little bit different. So they're trying to play the games that actually, you know, they have some implications to it. That's why you don't see, you know, like the Detroit Tigers and the White Sox on national TV too much. You know, I mean, because they're, neither one of them are performing very well.
That's valid.
So it's just a different philosophy. You know, the NBA is like, listen, our marquee matchups on Christmas Day, we have LeBron versus Kevin Durant. We got, you know, James Harden versus blah, blah, blah. And you just kind of go down the line and it's like, they market the crap out of that. You know what I mean? And like, that's the other thing too. You know, basketball numbers are going up because honestly, that they market it the right way. Uh-huh. Baseball numbers, you know, it's a little bit different because the game, it is pretty expensive to play. I mean, you know, leagues have to form and you have to have money for equipment and you need to have fields. And that's what's really lacking. You talk about like the inner city youth, and we've had this conversation before. They just don't have the number of fields that they need to play, and they don't have the money for the equipment.
Right.
So where does it all come from? You know, like you need, if you really want the popularity of your sport to go up and you want more kids playing it, then you need to make a concerted effort in that area. And I think they do with RBI and, you know, they do that kind of stuff, but it needs to be on a much bigger scale.
Yeah. I mean, where we're playing, we have one big park. It's got 8 diamonds and it's packed every day. You know, and that's good to see, but you know, it's not like that in Detroit. It's not like that in Flint. It's not like that in Saginaw. But Corey, you look, this is another, I think we could really go off into that because I think you and I, of my listeners, of my guests, are probably bigger baseball fans than anybody else. And, you know, but that all starts to kick in September when you start talking playoffs and stuff. But we got football coming up. How happy are you for football?
I'm very happy. I'm very happy. I can't wait. For me, it's just, you know, the summer gets kind of long, and when the Tigers aren't really in it, you start to kind of really start looking forward to that next little fix, and that's football, man, and I can't wait for it.
Me too. I can't wait to talk to you, check in with you about football throughout the rest of the season. Corey, it's been great, and I appreciate you coming back on.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, we'll see you, man. Thanks. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Appreciate it. Thanks for Corey for stopping by again after a busy summer. Having a real good talk, getting ready for football season, and I know we're going to be hitting that pretty hard, like we hit basketball pretty good. So real excited to get into that, real excited to get back into the swing of the show. I got a couple other guests lined up already and recorded dates scheduled, so we're not going to have gaps again, at least I think. So everybody, thanks for listening. Make sure you follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at FNGeese. That's FNGEESE. And you can email me at menasal@gmail.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.